In our lives, we come across things that can be frustrating or annoying. And often, as the case may be, you can live with something that's frustrating or annoying for a little while, and then you simply get rid of the thing that is frustrating or annoying so you can move on with your life. I had this opportunity recently with a shoe. One of the shoes was worn out on the left-hand side, and the heel was not giving me the support I needed, and I could tell these shoes have walked their last mile. And my grandmother gave me good advice. And I remembered her this last week as I needed to get new shoes. Don't buy used shoes. I love to buy used stuff, save a little bit of money. This is a good thing to do. But no, Grandma Eunice said, always take care of your feet more than anything else. So I'm going to buy new shoes to replace the ones that were annoying me and frustrating. When it comes to our interactions with one another, when things between us can be frustrating or annoying, it can be like a burr in the saddle. Something that rubs away underneath the saddle as things are moving, and eventually it becomes too much to bear. How do we deal with frustrations, with annoyances between our relationships, between how we treat other people? That's what I want to look at today as we pay attention to this text in 1 Corinthians 13. If you had the opportunity to be here on Saturday, we had a wedding here, and the same text was chosen by the bride and groom for this wedding. So if you were there, well, good news. You can kind of take a little nap right now. It's the same text. It's going to be the exact same sermon. No differences at all. In this sermon series, we're going to be reading from a bunch of different passages of Scripture. We're trying to play off of a text, a book written by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, as you may know, lived just before through the Second World War, and he was taken into a concentration camp in Germany. He was a German, and he was writing on behalf of the church all kinds of good writings in terms of what it means to be Christian in this time. And eventually he was killed because he was perceived, and he was, against the Führer, against Hitler. We're going to use Dietrich Bonhoeffer as our guide. And last week, Bonhoeffer led us into this idea that Christ is between us. So playing off of Ephesians, we looked at the idea of what it means for Christ to be between me and you. I can't quite see who you are truly and fully. We never really know one another. But Christ allows us to understand what does it mean for us to relate with one another so that we can actually know Christ better. And in so doing, actually treat one another more truly as Christ sees one another and as Christ longs for each other to be treated. This week, we're going to take the idea of community a little further. So in Bonhoeffer's book, there are these categories, beginning with community, and then moving into the day together, the day alone, service or ministry, and then confession and the sacraments. And we're going to continue in the idea of community today, but we're going to pay attention to what happens when there's trouble between us. What happens when there's disagreement within us? And I want to use this text in order to direct us back towards how God asks us to behave with one another. This is a chart. I hope you all brought your glasses. This is the denominations of the Christian faith. So at the top here, this is the apostles, and then a bunch of churches that split off into different areas of the world. Over here, we've got Anglicans and Catholics, or I think on the far left here. Everybody following along? Yeah. So there's a few denominations in the Christian tradition. It seems that Christianity has this propensity to split and to schism. And if you notice this chart here, if you go all the way down to right there, that one, is us. And you guys all know our denomination, right? We're the Christian and Missionary Alliance. I think there's actually very few people in this room who are staunch Christian and Missionary Alliance attendees. I think the vast majority of us here have come from other churches and find that this church can be their home in this time and in this season. What is going on in the Christian tradition that there are that many denominations splitting, breaking apart, that people are going from church to church, that this is the Christian experience in the modern age? I think many of those denominational splits, and we could go through the history, and it's really interesting to see why do these splits and schisms happen. Often it's over the treatment of some doctrine or some dogmatic idea of how we think church should be run. Maybe it's over women in leadership. Maybe it's over human sexuality. Right now, that's what denominations are splitting over right now. So it's often over something that we say we believe in. And I wonder if in fact what has happened is we've already broken apart and we're using this doctrinal idea as the reason that we're going to no longer have fellowship with one another, but we actually broke apart a little while ago when we no longer lived in love with one another. I wonder, could it be that the break isn't necessarily because we have different ideas, but actually we no longer know how to love one another truly and deeply? In human institutions, in the way that humans gather and group together, you can see this in elections, we often get caught up in a movement or an idea. We see something that we think is going to be very good, and so we want to follow that, contribute to it, give generously of our time and of our money, and we want this to succeed. But then along the way, something's going to get a little frustrating. And if it doesn't change, we're going to take our own stuff and we're going to take it over here to a place where we aren't getting frustrated. And maybe after a little bit of time, the little burn, the saddle's there. Well, actually, this time I don't want to move. I'm going to make you guys move and I'm going to hold this zone. This seems to be what's happening in Christian denominations, and they split and split and split. And I wonder if what's happening is that we can build communities around faith and hope fairly easily. When you think of faith, this is the idea that we have the sense that our leader is going to take things to be good. And we have this loyalty to our leader or to our leadership. Faith in our leaders. Faith that our leader is not as corrupt as the other leaders. Or there's hope. Hope is a sense of vision, what can be, what we long for. We hope it's going to be the reality. So faith and hope can draw us together as a community. Sometimes these can be switched out for love. And so we can talk about faith in a leader, and what we actually are talking about is loyalty in that leader. And we might even use the words of love. We love this leader or this leadership, or we love this idea or this ideal. But I think what we're actually talking about is faith and hope, not actually love, and we're using the word where it shouldn't be used. What Bonhoeffer does that I find helpful here. So Paul talks about how faith, hope, and love remain, but the greatest of these is love. Bonhoeffer takes the idea a little bit further, and I think it's quite helpful here because he distinguishes two ways of loving. One is the, he calls, self-referential love, or what I'm going to use the words of, sentimental love. Self-referential is the kind of love that really refers back to yourself more than to the other being or to Jesus Christ. Sentimental love. This idea of nostalgia for what once was is often becomes a sentimental sort of a love. I love something because I love the way it makes me feel, the sentiment, the emotion that I get from it, the feeling that I get from it. It's now romanticized in my mind. Ultimately, it's rooted in my desire. What I long for, what I'm feeling or getting out of it, this is what I truly love. I love something because of the way it makes me feel. Or I love a person because of the way that person makes me feel. If they didn't make me feel good, I wouldn't love them. I used to make pottery, and I like to make mugs differently than other handles. If you see on this mug, the handle is upside down. And I find that that fits the way I like to hold a mug quite well, either because my hand is on an angle, because that's the way gravity works. I don't understand other mug handles. But so for me, this makes gravity sense, but also it gives me the space to slide my hand in because I like to warm my hands around the mug for comfort. I love the way the mugs that I make me feel. I love the mug. The mug in this picture is cracked. I don't use it anymore. I don't think about it. It sits on a shelf. It has some still sentimental value to me because it's part of a package of pottery items that I made for my wife as part of her graduation. But I don't love the mug anymore, do I? I loved the way the mug made me feel, and when it cracked, I lamented and grieved it because no longer was it going to give me that feeling, that sense of comfort as I used it. Similarly with people. Do we love the way people make us feel, or do we actually love the other person? Is it sentimental love? Or is it deep, authentic love? If that person is no longer able to make us feel the way that they did when we first met them and fell in love, if they no longer can make us feel that way decades into our marriage, do I still love them if I don't feel the way they used to make me feel? If you've been paying attention to your Instagram feeds, you'll know that older people can still have love with their spouse. They can make each other feel butterflies even still. And this is wonderful. What happens when you don't have those feelings? When the other person does not generate in you the feelings that fit the understanding of what love is, it should make me feel a certain way. If it doesn't, do you still love that person? Sentimental, self-referential love is driven by desire. It's an end in itself. So as we're thinking about church and church community, how do you think about love in terms of relating to members of the church? Well, if this sentimental or self-referential love is what forms and shapes a community, what you end up happening is that that love is in itself the goal. I like the way I feel on Sunday morning. The way I get to participate in things gives me a sense of affirmation, gives me a sense of belonging. These are good things. God wants you to feel these things. They're good things, but they can also become idols, of course. They can become the point in themselves, and what you love is actually what you're feeling. I'm a big fan of feelings. I don't think feelings should be distrusted and made the caboose of the engine, as in my childhood, that's what we were taught. Think with your minds, but your feelings should follow what you think. Not so. Feelings are actually incredibly good data as to how the Spirit is working in you. But we don't want them to become our idols, right? We don't want to become bound by our feelings. Now, in church context, when we disagree about things, when we come across something that is the burr in the saddle, my dad, Gordon Smith, gives us a helpful little article. It's called, Can We Agree to Disagree? And he talks about three ways in which we can agree to disagree. And he mentions that the first one is, well, okay, there's a disagreement in the church. What you should do is acknowledge that it's you don't agree with what's happening, but maybe it's something that you can actually stay silent on. You can forbearance, right? You can have that gift of the Holy Spirit to forbear with what's going on. I'm just going to let it go, but I don't agree. The second thing you can do is you can be the vocal minority, what we call in Canada, the loyal opposition. You can say, I think that's wrong. I'm going to still go along with the majority, but I'm going to make sure that you guys understand I think what we're doing here is the wrong thing to be doing. But I'm still in community, okay? And I'm not going to sabotage what's happening. I'm going to still participate authentically, but I just wanted to make sure that my concerns are heard. This is good and authentic. And then Gordon shows us a third way. Of course, at some point, this might happen where you realize no longer can I be in communion with this congregation. The disagreement is too sharp. This could happen on such a thing as if they don't believe that Jesus Christ is raised from the dead, and I find that to be a Christian, this is central to my faith, and I can no longer be in community with this congregation. Okay? So Gordon highlights these three ways. He wrote that article some time ago. In a more recent conversation with Mark Buchanan, Gordon and Mark are talking about what's happening in our world today, and what they're recognizing is no longer is this space for agree to disagree possible. But what's happening is a movement to authoritarianism. There isn't space for that minority voice. You're either with us or you should go somewhere else. I don't want to hear the minority voice anymore. I don't want to hear your concerns. If you don't like what we're doing, go down the street. We're missing out on something deeply problematic there. And I think if Gordon was to write the article again after listening to this sermon, he would say, oh, I think what's missing is love. We're caught up in sentimental, self-referential love. And as we get caught up in that kind of love, we can do all kinds of great works. The church can grow, the congregation can grow in numbers. You can be a huge church doing many incredible programs. You can be feeding the poor, clothing the naked, freeing the captives. And yet, if you do it without love, says Paul, you're just a noisy gong or a clashing cymbal. Verse 3, you gain nothing, you are nothing, says Paul. So even if you're doing incredibly good works, even if you sacrifice your body for your brothers and sisters, if you're doing it without love, you are simply nothing. And I think we can all grasp a little bit of that when we think in our workplaces or in our families, when we try to make things happen the way we'd like to, and even if they're good things, if we make them happen, and we can kind of be proud of what happened. Oh, look, the data shows that things went up instead of down. You feel some success, but if you're honest, if you pay attention to your heart, you recognize there's something missing. And if you're doing it without love, in fact, you recognize it's as good as nothing. Bonhoeffer speaks about this, spiritual love or the sentimental love. And he talks about that there's nothing easier for Christians to do than to go away, say perhaps for a weekend retreat, and to together form and shape this spiritual community that feels absolutely wonderful. But then, to try to bring that back into the regular day-to-day world, you recognize, oh, I kind of don't like the way that they do things on the regular. It was fine when we were in together for a short period of time, but when I come back with them, I'm kind of a little frustrated with them. What ends up happening is become self-centered. You're trying to recreate the feelings and experiences that you had in that space away. And what you fail to do is to live into the love of God. The love that is spoken of in this text is a love that we cannot make. Often when we talk about love in our world today, we think of something that I'm supposed to be able to create in myself or find in myself. I either can make love or I'm overwhelmed by love. But I want to show us a better way. That love isn't something that you make. Love is something that already is. As we talked about last Sunday, playing off of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's idea that Christ is between us, then love is actually already present. The love of the brother or sister who's in front of me is already present. I don't have to make it or create it or manipulate it. It doesn't have to come from me. It's already there. What I need to do is resonate with it or echo with it. The love of Christ, the love through Christ for the other person. And this is that love. If you are a miner, none of us here are miners, I don't think, who go out and do mining, but you can imagine, if you will, being a miner in a tunnel, and the tunnels are many tunnels branching off different ways, and it's dark, and you don't want to get lost. Perhaps there's a string guiding you from where you're working all the way back to the entrance. And so, in the pitch black, even if you didn't have your light on, you can grab the string and find your way back in the darkness. I think the love of Christ that's spoken of in this text is like that thread. So as you go about your day to day, as you're wondering, how am I supposed to be a Christian faithfully in this world, faithfully in this congregation, do so through love, just reach out. The line is always just an arm's reach away. Reach out to this line, this description of love, and let it be your guidance back to the light. Because this is what love is. Love is patient. As simple and as pure as that. If you're wondering, how am I supposed to love? I've seen the Hollywood movies, and I've read the books, the romance novels. Maybe you're all into those books, and you grab them off the shelf, and you read, this is what love is supposed to do and how I'm supposed to feel. No. Read this text. Love is first and foremost patient. And if you have your Bible open with you, I'd encourage you to keep it open as I go through this text, as it's so deeply referential to each verse, as you will, because I think that each point about love is dependent on the one that comes after it. How can love be patient? There is frustration in my life. There are burrs in the saddles of whatever I am doing. How is love able to be patient in this world in which we live? Love is able to be patient because love is kind. You see, kindness enables patience. If love is kind, it will then be patient. And if you want to be patient, then you simply need to be kind. Letting my kindness towards a person guide my thoughts and actions, I will therefore be patient with them. Love is patient because love is kind. How is love kind in a world in which it seems so incredibly hard? With our divisions between us, how can we always be kind? Well, love is able to be kind because love is not envious or boastful. Love is not arrogant or rude. You see, if you compare yourself to your brother or sister, you will have a very hard time being kind to them. If you see yourself as ahead of them and you're worried if they're going to catch up with you, if you're comparing yourself to them, you're not going to want to be kind to them. Envying one another, boasting or showing off, this will cripple your ability to be kind to one another. At best, it'll make your kindness a veneer, fake. Arrogance will smother kindness. If you are arrogant, you simply cannot be kind. And rudeness. If rudeness is present, then kindness is not. But the special thing is, if kindness is present, then rudeness is not. Love is patient and love is kind because love is not envious, boastful, arrogant, or rude. This is why love is kind, because the stuff that would erode kindness simply is not present in love. How can love be this way? How can love be never envious, boastful, arrogant, or rude? This seems difficult again. Well, love is not envious, boastful, arrogant, or rude because love does not insist on its own way. Love does not insist on its own way. And I think what this means is that it doesn't mean that love never has its own desire. So I spoke about the sentimental love earlier being focused and caught up in our own desires. But love itself does have desires, but love never insists on its own way. It never demands that its desires be fulfilled. Because love does not insist on its own way, it is not envious, boastful, arrogant, or rude. By not insisting on its own way, it's free of those temptations or traps that we face. That seems hard. How does love never insist on its own way? I have children. I'm using the same illustrations in case you didn't know, because it's helpful for me. But I have children. And as I raise my children, certainly I come across times and places where I need to insist on my own way. Things need to be this way. And my favorite argument in this point is to say, well, because I said so. You've said why a whole bunch of times, and I've given you my whys, and they don't seem to be winning the way, so now it's just because. I'm insisting on my own way at this point, because we got to get out the door, right? This is how parents have to operate in order to function in this world, so surely love must, at some point, have to insist on its own way. But love does not insist on its own way. How so? Because love is not irritable, and it does not keep a record of wrongdoings. I'm just irritated I'm late. So that's why I have to insist on my own way. Love doesn't insist on its own way because it is not irritable and it does not keep a record of wrongdoings. How easy it is for us to be irritable and to feel the need to insist on our own way. This time it's my turn. Or to keep a record of wrongdoings. Oh, I'll forgive, but I won't forget. I remember the times when this happened, and you know what? Now it's my turn. I'm going to insist on my own way because I've been keeping score. Nothing breaks apart our relationships more than keeping score, especially in a marriage, but also in our church community, as we keep score of who's had the turn, who's had the talking stick more, who's had their right of way more than I have. Maybe now it's my turn. If you are keeping score, it will erode your ability to not insist on your own way. Therefore, it will erode your ability to participate in the love of Christ. Love does not insist on its own way because it does not keep a record of wrongdoings and it is not irritable. What's the secret to this? How can love be free of these emotions that we know so well if we are self-aware? Love is able to be free of those because, says Paul, love does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. And this is so key. Love does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but it rejoices in the truth. That sounds fairly easy, right? Don't we all want to rejoice only in truth and never in wrongdoing? But I find that it creeps in subtly. When we feel threatened, or when we feel greedy, when we feel even just cranky, I didn't get enough sleep, or when we feel despair and lost, when we're feeling like we're not quite getting everything we want to have happen. There can be moments when we actually rejoice in wrongdoing, when we see something else happen in a negative light for somebody. You know, I did think they needed to come down a peg. They were getting a bit too big for their britches. I'm kind of glad they tripped and fell and scraped their knee. How easy it is for us to rejoice in wrongdoing that happens to another person. When tragedy or calamity befalls them, oh, sure, we can send them the pot pie that says, I'm sorry this happened to you. But there might be a little part of us that's saying, you know what? It's probably about time that happened to them. And it happens in small, subtle ways. Little moments where we kind of rejoice in wrongdoing because it advances something that we want. You see it in baseball. I always get this way around this time of the year because the Toronto Maple Leafs play in hockey. And so usually they give me a good sermon illustration, and I'm just waiting a couple more weeks, and I'm sure I'll have a good one about suffering, sacrifice, and loss. Did I just do that 2 weeks in a row? Yeah. Sorry, and Steve left. There he goes. Yeah, don't use the same one 2 weeks in a row. That's beating on the poor Maple Leaf fans, which I really do like doing. But you don't rejoice in wrongdoing if you're connected to love, do you, Micah? Don't rejoice in wrongdoing. Don't rejoice in the downfall of your brother or sister when they stub their toe and you kind of are thinking like, okay. Love does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but it rejoices in the truth. Always, every time, and without fail. How does love do this? How does it never slip up in the way that we slip up in our relationships? Love does this because love bears all things. Love is able to receive and take all things in. It bears all things. It can hold them. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. No matter what, love can take it. And no matter what happens, love believes. Love believes in the health and wealth of that and the flourishing of this person. Love believes in this person. And no matter whatever happens, love will always find another way and another moment to trust. Love believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. Even in the darkest moments and the smallest places, when the rest of us would have given up hope and let the rope go and no longer holding on to help them up, love hopes. Love hopes and love endures. Love endures all things because love never ends. As I've moved through this text and see how the description of love builds upon itself, the way Paul layers it, you have to see that as we get to the end of this, you must realize this is not a love that you can make or form. This is not something that you can simply do. It's beyond you. What this text is inviting you into is not a love that you can create in yourself. It's also beyond the way something makes you feel. So that I can actually connect to this love, even if the person in front of me is no longer making me feel in such a manner that I feel good about this person, I can still love them because I can connect to this love that is Jesus Christ between us. This love that is beyond us is something that we can pay attention to. Like the line in the dark, we can reach out and grab a hold of. We can resonate in it. We can echo it with our actions and therefore participate in something greater that we could ever make or do. How do we take this practically into our week tomorrow? Again, I turn to Bonhoeffer. He gives us something that I find very helpful. After he's been talking about love in the community for a little while in the book, he brings out this idea that if you truly want to love someone in a non-sentimental way, I want you to speak to Jesus Christ about that person more than you speak to that person about Jesus Christ. I want you to speak to Jesus about this person more than you speak to this person about Jesus. And it doesn't just mean I go to this person, I tell them Jesus loves them and has a wonderful plan for them. I just mean go to them and tell them you think things could be different in their life, that they could do things differently. You're still trying to be and speak Christ to them. Instead of speaking Christ to them, speak to Christ about them. And don't be Moses here in Numbers chapter 11 when he goes and speaks to God about the people that he works with and says, I'm done with this, I'd rather be dead than work with the people you have. Don't go and complain to God about the people around you, but instead go to Jesus Christ and take that person before Christ and actually pray for them, not to be changed the way you'd like them to be changed, but pray for them such that you are bringing them to God and interceding on their behalf. Oh God, would you bless this person? And what you will find is as you speak to Christ about the person, more than you speak to the person about the way you think they should be, you will love them. You will love them in the manner of this text. You will learn in speaking to Christ about them, in taking them before the altar of God and saying, God, would you please bless this person? You will learn to be patient and kind. You will be completely free of being envious, boastful, arrogant, or rude. You will not rejoice in wrongdoing that happens to them, but instead you will rejoice in truth and blessing for them because you've already been praying for it. And you won't be irritable or resentful towards them. Instead, you will learn what it means to bear all things from them. You will learn what it means to believe for them and in them. You will learn what it means to hope for them and to hope with them. And you will learn how to endure all things, not because you can endure all things that this person might do to you, not because you can endure it, but because love can. And you're praying to Christ so that he would bless them and his love would endure all things through them and for them. Pray to Christ about them more than you speak to them about Christ. This is hard, again. Like last Sunday, it's all in your head. And I'm inviting you to do a lot of mental homework about your relationships that you're involved in. Well, I have good news for you. The more that you do this, the more natural it becomes, and the less you'll have to force it and take time away from actually interacting with the person and reflecting on how did I do today with my marriage, or how did I do today with my children, or how did I do today with my workmates? And was I loving? Where did I fail in that? You need to do that, but over time, you'll find less and less you have to do that because it'll become more and more natural for you to love in the manner that Christ loves, for you to resonate and dwell in the love of Christ. Because as Paul says, now we see only in part, we know only in part, we're seeing through a glass dimly, but when the authentic love of Christ dwells in us, when we echo it, when we have a hold of that line in the dark, what ends up happening is we can know fully the love of God for this person and for ourselves. And we can dwell in that eternal love, even if we only get a glimpse of it in this moment. We're tasting, we're participating in the eternal, which one day we will do forever and ever. This is the love of Christ that I am inviting you into. May this week, as you go forth, be a week of searching for and participating in this love. And may it always be that line in the dark for you, guiding you home, guiding you to the light. Amen.